Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
There's another story at the bottom of the front page of the Irish Times today as well. Second woman had affair with Bishop Casey, and it's written by Arthur Beasley, but it is a story from a book by Patsy McGarry, and Patsy McGarry joins me now. Good morning, Patsy.
Good morning, Brendan.
So, Patsy, you've been a religious affairs correspondent with the Irish Times since 1997.
Correct.
Quarter of a century at least, and you've written a memoir of that time. And I suppose what's interesting about it too is it coincides with the decline of the Catholic Church in Ireland. So an element of the Catholic Church in my part and its downfall. Just to start at the beginning and set the scene for us, maybe, you paint a picture first of the Ireland you grew up in, right? And I think some of it will astonish young people. Tell younger listeners, for example, what the stations were and about the day they came to your house.
Yeah, there was a tradition in rural Ireland particularly, and I think it continues in certain parts of the country still, whereby a family home would host a mass. It was called the stations. And it tended to go in a circuitous route. Every so often a family would, say, every 10 years thereabouts, would have a stations in their house. It happened once in my lifetime out in rural Roscommon, in Mullen, as it was called, as I was living there then. And the local priest came along and he said mass. He was a very strict man of the old school. Everybody was afraid of their lives of him. And it was my introduction to the Catholic Church. I was
and the whole house time. Would be done up for this. Like, he thought of rethatching the roof for that day.
Yeah. They decided it wasn't necessary, but the house was whitewashed, repapered inside. My grandfather's bedroom was turned into a dining room with all this cutlery. A lot of it was borrowed and delf, etc. And it was the first time I ever saw grapefruit. I tasted it, I wasn't supposed to, and I never touched grapefruit for many, many years after.
And this was so that it would be a fitting place
for the
worthy
priest.
Of a priest to eat. Yeah. And then you moved to Ballatadreen then. And again, I mean, this almost surprises me, but even though I kind of remember this Ireland in a way, Ballatadreen was completely dominated, like economically, by the Catholic Church. They were stuck into, they ran everything in the town, basically.
They were on every committee, if not chairs, priests were, of every committee in the town at the time. And just to give you an idea of how monochrome or homogenous it was, there was one Protestant family in the town of 1,200 people, and that was the local doctor's family. Today in Ballatadreen, there are 27 nationalities in our primary school, and almost half, if not more, of our population is non-national. I mean, it's a complete contrast to what it was then. When we moved in, the town's population then was about 1,200. Now it's about 2,400. Massive change. But to go back to your original point, education was a big thing in Ballatadreen when we moved in there. It's one of the reasons why my father moved into the town and wanted us to move in there, because St. Nathie's was a very well-respected and still is secondary school, but then run by priests. It was the junior seminary for the Diocese of O'Connery, boys boarding school. There was the Sisters of Charity ran an orphanage, a secondary school for girls and a primary school for girls. The De La Salle brothers had a primary school for boys, which I attended, including the son of that Protestant family who sat beside me in school. And one of the first times I began to question Catholicism was, I couldn't believe that this young, mild lad was destined for hell and all the rest of these mad ruffians in my classmates were going to go to heaven simply because he was Protestant. And they were very active in the town itself. The bishop lived locally, the Bishop of O'Connery. He had lived in what was called a palace outside the town, an old neo-Gothic building.
When you say they were on every committee, like, this is not committees to do with the church?
Not at all. Football, bridge, golf, you name it. Every committee in the town had a priest member, if not a priest chair.
And was everybody completely deferential to them?
People were, hugely so. And of course, there was, apart from huge respect for the church's institution, it was a huge economic factor in the town. I mean, these big schools had to be serviced, and the services came from local shops, whether it be bread or, I mean, we had big shops at the time, Duff's and Flannery's, who had their own bakeries, etc., supplied these schools. And so they were knit in economically into the life of the town too.
And then the other aspect of this, you mentioned going to the De La Salle. Your Catholic education was pretty brutal, as I think it was for a lot of people.
Not exceptionally so. It was typical. and it was a pretty rough school. I mean, the brothers were... I came from a rural school run by one woman teacher, and she was strict, but I got on very well with her. And then I moved in to the Dalhousie School in Ballaghera. I was just another one of this huge horde of boys. And it was a brutal regime. I mean, the strap and the cane and even the drumstick was used very, very liberally to beat lads. And but we thought that was normal. And indeed, if you didn't go home and tell, I mean, it's a cliche at this stage, you didn't go home and tell your parents that you'd been beaten in school, because they'd say, what did you do wrong? And you could probably be beaten again. Because corporal punishment was an integral part of Irish life where children were concerned at that time. And let's not forget that corporal punishment was legal in Ireland until the early 1980s. Mm. And in that, I have to say, Ireland wasn't exceptional. I think Sweden was the first country to ban it. And that was also in the early 80s. So, I mean, it was typical of the time.
Yeah. You were quite religious. I think you kind of feel, and I think this probably happened to a lot of guys, that you could easily have become a priest.
Yes.
By chance, really.
Not by chance, by decision.
Yeah.
I was a very, very religious youngster. I was very devout. I was very taken by the social justice aspects of Catholicism, and I still would be. And I believed very deeply, mainly under the influence of my first woman teacher, Mrs. Ford, who was a deeply devout woman. My mother, who was quite religious but not pious or overtly religious as well. And at that time, I grew into it. And then in secondary school, I began to ask questions. And I wasn't getting answers. There weren't any. I mean, I did say in the book how one priest who was in charge of our Christian doctrine class, I asked him, Father, how do we know there's a God? And it was as if I said to him, how do we know there's air? How do we know there's water? For him, it was self-evidently the case. He had never questioned the fact in his life, but I was on a questioning route and I began to question initially the authority of the church, the abuse of that authority, which I saw in my own small town in a mild way. And because I have to say that most of the clergy were decent people, as they still are. And then it went on from there to questioning the divinity of Christ. And that's where I hit a wall. The divinity of Christ. I do believe he existed. I do believe his teachings are probably the best we have in the Western world. But as to his divinity, I couldn't cross that. I lost that faith.
Okay, yeah. When I said by chance, you do say in the book, though, that if you would possibly, if your education had gone a different route, and you might have gone that route.
To be fair to you, Brendan, yes, that's true. But what I meant by that was Vatican II happened when I was in secondary school, which opened up a whole vista of questioning that hadn't been there before.
Okay.
Had that not happened for a few years afterwards, and I've had this discussion with colleagues of my own age in the paper, I probably would have gone into a seminary. Whether I'd have lasted or not is another story.
So you got another pulpit instead. So as a lapsed Catholic then, how did you end up as religious affairs correspondent with the Irish Times?
I was more than a lapsed Catholic, Brendan. I was an agnostic and avowedly so. And I stopped practicing early in university. My route into journalism, I came from a very political background. My father was Fianna Fáil County Councillor, although he wasn't in my younger years. That happened after 1974, when Liam Cosgrave's government cleared the way for that Fianna Fáil man to become a politician. He was a health inspector and they weren't allowed to enter politics up to that point. But I saw the politics from the inside of my own house, and I saw the way Fianna Fáil in particular was going, and I wasn't attracted to it. I was more, if you like, left of centre. I was aware of the shenanigans that were going on in the party, even locally. And so, I mean, the next option seemed to be journalism, and I was always attracted to journalism. But I found it very difficult to get in there. I didn't have any family connections with the media. I did work for the student newspaper in Galway, Unity, as it was called at the time. And I found it very hard to break into journalism when I came up here to Dublin.
Okay, so you become the religious affairs correspondent for the Irish Times. And as I say, it's at a very kind of... may you live in interesting times, I suppose. One thing that's clear throughout the book is that you are very, very angry with the church, and in particular in terms of its dealings with child abuse.
I would refine that a little and say I was very, and remain less so probably now, but very angry with the church authorities.
Okay.
I talk about bishops and religious superiors. Not so much with the priests and nuns in the field, who had to get on with the job, even as the whole edifice was collapsing around them, and still do a good job on the ground. I was very angry at the way that these men, predominantly, when they're made aware of abuse, covered it up, moved the accused priest to another parish, usually a working class parish, where the people were less likely to question the authority of the priest, and moved him again when further allegations emerged. There are so many examples of this, for instance, in the Ryan report, I should say probably more so the Ferns report, which is the first one that came out in 2005, the Murphy report, which looked at Dublin, the Cloyne report, which looked at Cloyne and East Cork, your own part of the world, and less so again with the Mother and Baby Home Commission, and to a degree the Magdalen Laundry. So this same pattern where authority was concerned, rather than address the issue and to with one purpose only, to protect the institution, they moved these guys around, and they were more culpable than the abuser, because the abuser was usually a person with a problem and generally is with a psychological, a deep-seated psychological problem. They move them around and again, and there's a line in the Murphy report that is embedded in my brain. For the earlier period investigated, up from 1975, it began then, to 2004, the welfare of children wasn't even a consideration where the Archbishops of Dublin were concerned. That's a shocking indictment. Yeah. Of an institution.
Yeah, and not believing these people who often didn't have possibly the education and the confidence to really go up against the priest, discrediting them and believing the priests over them. You mentioned the Murphy report there, and that was the investigation into the Dublin diocese. Yeah, and that came out in 2009. Tell me about that press conference, because we talked about the deference earlier that you grew up with. The deference was well and truly gone that day. So you got up first and laid into them. Yeah.
Before talking about my heroism, Brendan, let me talk about Mary Raftery, which made that commission possible. I mean, Mary Raftery was we're talking about the Nell, who was a great woman. There was no doubt about it. I mean, I remember Nell coming down to Galway when I was a student, and she was on a panel with the then Bishop of Galway, Micheál Brown, who was very much a representative of the old school authoritarian dour, I say, therefore you deliver attitude. Nell got up and did Nell, and we were just a lecture hall full of kids and were really responding to her, and he just got up and walked out. That was Nell. And in the same of the same mind would be people like Mary Raftery. Mary did her States of Fear series, which led to the Ryan Commission report, an enormous tome, 2,600 pages long, which investigated the abuse of children in reformatories, industrial schools, orphanages, etc. And Mary, in 2002, broadcast through this station, Cardinal Secrets, which led to the Murphy report, and indeed the Cloyne report, and indeed other reports subsequently, and I doff my hat to Mary Raftery. Yeah. But what you're talking about is, I was of course incensed at that particular press conference in November 2009 when the Murphy report was published. It was launched in the Martyr Day Institute by the then Archbishop of Dublin, Jeremy Martin, a man I deeply respect, and some senior clergy from the Archdiocese. I had just had a chance to have a quick gloss of the report before I came out to the press conference. It's not a very long report. It's a very powerful report. It's very lucidly and clearly written. I think it's an example of what reports should be. And I left in a temper, the newsroom in a temper, and I arrived in a temper, and I got up in a temper, and I did not know what I was going to say. And I suppose it was from the gut. I did make a point of trying to exclude Archbishop Martin from responsibility for what I was about to say. And I lacerate the church and said, how can we respect this institution when the commission, which had written to Rome looking for cooperation, got no cooperation from Rome, when it wrote to the then papal nuncio asking for his cooperation and he did not cooperate, the church authority at Roman level and at local level didn't cooperate, except for Jeremy Martin, who handed over 80,000 documents from the archives in the Dublin Archdiocese, which his predecessor attempted to stop because he argued that 5,000 of those archival documents were relevant personally to him.
Nell got up next, did she?
Nell got up next, and Nell did what Nell did, and she let them have it, absolutely. And then my colleague and your former colleague here, Joe Little, also chimed in.
A kind of a nice, mild-mannered man, Joe Little, absolutely. You would have thought. And he laid into them as well.
Yeah, I've been described as the same myself, Brendan, occasionally, but it depends on people, by people who know me less, I suppose.
So look, I suppose for lots of people, the beginning of their disillusionment with the church was Bishop Eamon Casey and the Annie Murphy affair. You were an admirer of his, were you?
I was an admirer of his prior to any of this emerging, because of the work he did with Trocra. And he co-founded Trocra, which has been probably a shining star where the Catholic Church's activity from Ireland is concerned in the third world, as we used to call it, or the developing world. He's done enormously good work out there. I admired him for his stance in Central and South America. I admire for the fact that he went to Oscar Romero's funeral, was nearly killed himself when the government authorities opened fire on the people attending that funeral, and dozens of people were shot dead. I mean, his affairs of women was something I became aware of after Annie Murphy.
Tell me then about that trip. So this was after the Annie Murphy story had come out. He was out in Ecuador.
Yeah.
You were actually on leave, were you? You headed out to Ecuador to
find
him.
I decided to take a chance. I had been appointed as Regis Affairs correspondent in March of that year. And this is about August, September of 1997. I decided just to go out there and just see. I stopped off in Cuba because the Pope was due to visit there the following January, which I covered as well for the paper. And I went down to Ecuador. I had got his address, and I actually can't remember now how I got it, and went out to this Los Bancos area where he had been living for 5 years. At that stage, a very, very poor part of Ecuador. The conditions of the people were shockingly, the poverty was obvious and endemic. He transformed this church building, which is typically South American, apparently, before he arrived, and brightened it up, etc. He had very poor Spanish. He was living with three other priests, one of whom had English. He was very isolated. He was very lonely. I wanted to do the interview. He wouldn't agree to an interview. And so I brought a bottle of whiskey, which I tended to leave him when I left, and we opened it. I didn't realise he wasn't really a whiskey drinker. He was a wine drinker. And I had a copy of Nulo Fuelon's Are You Somebody, which I left to him because he knew all the personalities involved as well. And I was very moved by his situation at the time. And then he came, we remained in contact and by phone. And there was deep resistance to him coming back to Ireland.
Just before we get to that, so he stayed up all night drinking whiskey. And as you say, you made this connection. You say in the book, marvellous company.
Yeah.
And he choked up when you were leaving then, yeah, and thanked you for the respect and everything. But just take what we knew then about Casey, yeah, right? Had you no issue with how he treated Annie Murphy? Like, this was a young, vulnerable woman. A son that he refused to acknowledge. He said to Annie Murphy, he's your son, I'm nothing to do. And then embezzling diocesan funds to funnel to them. Did you have no problem with that?
Of course I did, Brent. And I wasn't as familiar with as much of the detail then as I did become afterwards, because I did meet Peter, and Peter filled me in, and I interviewed him as well for the paper. And a very impressive guy.
Yeah, I want to ask you about Peter.
Cut out of his father.
Yeah.
And Annie, I admired hugely, particularly the manner in which she handled herself on The Late Late Show with Gay Byrne. When she responded, I'm not so bad myself, when he said, if Peter was half the man his father was, etc., etc., etc. As regards the money, and I'm not making light of it, it was paid back very quickly. I would have imagined that he intended to pay it back anyhow. Fine. And that's how the Irish Times, if you like, follow the story. They follow the money rather than the affair.
I know, but I suppose, and like, you know, this is now just what we knew then. I suppose the hypocrisy of the man as well at that point. Like, this pillar of a church that had shamed and destroyed so many Irish people for having sex, for being human, right? And it turns out he was only human too. Sure, he made fools of the people, like.
Well, he was a hypocrite, but it's not a crime. And if it was, not many of us would survive such a charge. There's no doubt about it, the revelation that he had a son was deeply shocking for a lot of old school Irish Catholics in particular. It does highlight the madness of the mandatory celibacy rule, where Catholic priests are concerned. At least it should be optional. But anyhow, he believed it. He did believe in it, and he did preach it, celibacy himself. He wasn't as much a hypocrite as Michael Cleary. He used to go on radio giving out about extramarital sex while going back then to Phyllis Hamilton, with whom he had two children. But that's just a scale of rogues, if you like.
So you got to know Peter, his son, a bit. Yeah. And so they had developed a relationship at that point.
Not father-son relationship so much as two. They became very, very friendly. They used to meet regularly in the States. When Casey was in the States initially, before he went to Ecuador, and then afterwards, mainly in Boston, and they used to have these massive dinners, etc., and they became good
friends. With the wine that he
favoured.
Loads
of wine, loads of wine. Both men like wine, like the good life.
So they did. He did ultimately, I think he said to Peter, eventually said, OK, I'll meet you, you have questions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was
so
the beginning.
I'll answer what I can.
I mean, the initial meeting was when Peter was, he's about 16, before it emerged at all, and they met in New York, and it was not a good meeting at all. Peter just couldn't hack it, and his father wasn't friendly to him. But after the revelations, and after he fled to America, they met out there, and it took a while for the two men to warm, well, certainly for Peter to warm to him. But they did. They developed a relationship, which wasn't a father-son relationship.
Yeah.
It was more friendship or whatever, although he did help to fund Peter's education at third level in the United States.
Okay. From his own resources. With his own money. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And there's a very sad little vignette there of the last time Peter called his father, and Eamon Casey doesn't know who he is.
No.
So when you were mentioning there, so Casey came back to Ireland, was it 2006?
Six, yeah.
And then this is brings us to the story on the front of the Irish Times today.
Yeah.
So would you have been one of the people at that time who thought Casey should have been let back into the ministry?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, I was one of the people who said he should be let back to Ireland after Ecuador. I felt he was being punished unduly, that the Irish people were more forgiving than the church authorities, whose concern wasn't so much with... their concern was that he'd become the focus of media attention, and he was a man who couldn't avoid attention. He liked it. So anyhow, to make a long story short, he ended up in the south of England in the Diocese of Arundel and Brighton, which the bishop current at that time was Murphy O'Connor, who had connections at Cork, and the network worked. And he was there for about 5 years before eventually he was allowed back to Ireland in 2006, and he was in Shanaglish in East Galway, a remote rural parish where he was away from media attention, and he settled down in there quite easily and became very friendly with the local people, but wasn't allowed, say, Mass, wasn't allowed public ministry. Now, at that stage, we were all aware of abuser priests, of bishops who'd covered up, who are allowed, say, Mass. And I and others thought this was outrageous, that he was being, it was revenge, if you like, for him. He was a bishop, fine, rather than a priest. I wrote a couple of pieces in the paper highlighting this as just the abuse of the church of this man, if you like. Father James Good, who himself had been moved from ministry in the late 1960s because he challenged the Humanae Vitae ruling of Pope Paul VI, which banned artificial means of contraception or continued the ban. And he came out and said it was a disgrace that Casey was being treated like this still.
Okay, so then you believe that this woman, this other woman who had the affair with Casey, was sent to you by the bishops, essentially.
Yeah, I don't know if she's necessarily the sort of person you could send.
Yeah.
She was a practicing Catholic. I knew her through mutual friends. We had met many times beforehand, and she asked to meet me confidentially. So she set up a meeting in the Westbury Hotel about 2008, and I met her and we had coffee and tea, and she told me the story that she'd went to London from Ireland after her convent education, etc., became involved with Shelter, of which Casey was co-founder and president at the time. This was an agency set up to house Irish immigrants initially, and then it extended to housing homeless people more generally, for which he got huge acclaim, not least here, because Ryrick did a programme about him in the late 1960s, and he was acclaimed as this new type of man, which is one of the reasons he became a bishop, I think. And anyhow... she and he had an affair, and it continued there into the late 60s period until he was appointed Bishop of Kerry. And he came back to Ireland, and though they resumed contact because she was in Ireland back that time too, the affair was not resumed. And I was intrigued as to why this woman who I knew wanted to tell me this, and why she was also binding me to confidence on the matter, telling me this as a journalist and in the particular role I had. And I asked her, it just dawned on me, I said, does the Bishop of Galway know you're coming to talk to me? And she said, yes. And the Bishop of Galway at the time was Martin Drennan. So then the penny dropped, and basically the signal being sent to me was, as has transpired since, they didn't know what else was going to emerge about Casey into the public domain. So the bishops couldn't afford, if you like, to restore him to public ministry.
Okay, and indeed, much worse was to emerge. We now know that Eamon Casey is alleged to have abused at least four children that we know of, and obviously we will be talking about abuse a little bit now, so I'd advise listener discretion at this point. His own niece says he raped her when she was five. He abused her for a decade after that, she says. Has all this caused you to reassess your views on Casey?
All I'll say, Brendan, is this is a very difficult situation. The dice is loaded against people making allegations when it comes to rape or whatever, because immediately the right of the accused to be innocent until proven guilty kicks in. And often the consequences for the person making the allegation is difficult in the legal system. All I do know is this, that, and I reported on it at the time in 2006, that Patricia made the allegation in 2005. First of all, November 2005, she was in the UK. He was in the UK. The guards investigated from the beginning of 2006. They met Patricia in the UK, interviewed her. It continued throughout 2006. And finally, they investigated. They met Casey himself, interrogated him for 6 hours. And within weeks, he was told there were no charges. There were 13 charges.
Yeah, he was astonished himself how quickly
he said that to me.
And the Garda Commissioner has now said that he wants to look at that because he says there's a query over the nature and efficiency and effectiveness of that investigation. He wants to be sure of the standard of the original investigation.
And I welcome
now,
that.
Now, there were four...
Yeah.
There were four accusers and also a child safety concern. There were alleged events in every diocese where Casey worked.
Yeah.
The Diocese of Limerick settled a High Court case with its fifth accuser, I think without admission, but for more than €100,000. There was another settlement paid by...
That was 2 years after he died. I'm just sticking to the facts. All I'm saying is this. The allegations are there. There is no evidence yet.
Allegations, Patsy. I mean, settlements have been made. Are you telling me that we were talking earlier about a church that wouldn't accept the abuse that did happen? Are you suggesting they now accepted and settled for abuse that maybe didn't happen? It would seem unlikely.
Without dealing with the specific case, Brendan, the church the bishops have not changed their tack. It's still about protecting the institution. And so now they daren't go into a court to challenge an abuse survivor, because they know what would happen. They'd be thrown out and they'd bring upon their heads the odium of the people. But so the
Hang on a minute. Yeah. You're suggesting that the church have settled with people, but that they have done it without believing those people.
Well,
as far as I know, the church does believe them. The current bishop, and they believe Casey's accusers. The current bishop of Limerick, Dr. Brendan Leahy, who has access to documents relating to complaints made in the diocese, he has said... They deserve our respect, belief and support. He says, I have no reason to disbelieve any of the allegations made. So even the church, with their appalling record in this, believe those women.
No, they don't disbelieve them. Let's not forget, Brendan, that
they deserve our respect, belief and support.
Yes, I agree. But he said he didn't disbelieve.
But he said they deserve our belief.
Fair enough. Yeah, and I agree with that. I mean, I've been on the side of abuse survivors all my career as a religious affairs correspondent,
I'm so surprised at your attitude to Casey.
Well, the point about it, Brendan, simply is that there are allegations, and allegations are not evidence, and the only case that has been tested didn't go to a judge.
Are you applying this burden of proof to all the child abuse that occurred in the church down the years? Because there was often very little proof. But what we have is we have four people from four different places independently accusing this man of something.
Yeah, none of them have gone to court.
Yeah, but there have been two settlements made. And I mean, a lot of these cases didn't. A lot of those cases historically never ended up in court.
Let's look at those two settlements.
Let's not, because you know what? I think at this stage we're being disrespectful to the victims and we're not. I accept that, Patsy. Yeah. But I think if we were to get in to start picking that apart,
right,
I think possibly
there'd
be. Okay, listen. The book is called Well, Holy God. It's published by Merriam Press. Patsy McGarry, thank you so much.